Good morning. Thank you all for being here for the early session. Thanks to my fellow panelists. So during the interwar years, shifts in France's population makeup, state policies, and culture reshaped the hexagon in myriad and far-reaching ways. And many of these changes were part of France's markedly increased orientation toward the wider Mediterranean. This shift was linked to the heightened importance of the empire more broadly. And as the work of a number of scholars in recent years has shown, the interwar period witnessed a plethora of colonial advertisements, exhibits, ceremonies, and publications. Simultaneously, there were growing numbers of colonial workers and students who became both subjects of constant police surveillance and agents of frequent political change. Other factors were also important in this turn toward the Mediterranean, and they included the increasing centrality of Algeria in particular to metropolitan politics, substantial numbers of Italian and Spanish immigrants, France's expanding importance within the Mediterranean itself as a power, and practical factors like dramatic increases in the speed of nautical transport and the advent of the airplane. Now, despite recent work on colonial culture and politics in the interwar metropole and the growing scholarly attention to France in a Mediterranean context, historians have largely overlooked the way that specifically in the years after World War I, metropolitan France became a space increasingly defined by its Mediterranean context. And so what I want to argue here is that the growing presence of Jews and Muslims in particular played a crucial role in this transformation. Going further, I would like to suggest that a focus on Jews and Muslims permits, even compels us, to recenter the history of France and its empire between the wars, maybe earlier as well, placing it as much in the northern portion of a burgeoning French Mediterranean as at the heart of Western Europe. To understand these changes, we need to attend to three overlapping stories about demography and everyday life, struggles to define the French nation and empire, and transnational subaltern political movements on mainland French soil. Each story, for the purposes of this paper, is about Jews and Muslims within the Mediterranean both as a lived geographical entity and as an imagined space of mythical unity and grandeur. In the first story, the dramatic growth of both populations led to the establishment of sociocultural spaces such as neighborhoods, cafes, and musical performances where Muslims and Jews recreated and adapted aspects of the culture and coexistence they had known in the Maghreb. In the second story, the two groups found themselves in the crosshairs of competing visions of French nationhood, wherein France's Mediterranean colonial possessions and subjects, particularly in Algeria, took on unprecedented importance. And these visions played out in particular around a pair of debates, the struggle between fascism and anti-fascism, and the growing question of the future of Algeria. Often in articulations both about and by Jews and Muslims, these two issues became closely interrelated. And the importance of these struggles crystallized following the 1934 Jewish-Muslim riots in Constantine, and even more so during the emergence of the Popular Front. These events in part shaped the last story, wherein a series of transnational political movements with links across the wider Mediterranean established footholds in France. And these ranged from anti-colonial nationalism to Islamic reform to Zionism. Some of these emerged in opposition to French colonial policies, others as part of a wider Jewish and Muslim diaspora politics. Now, because these three stories featured some of the same actors and unfolded concurrently, they enable us to see in what situations Jewish and Muslim ethno-religious identity came to the fore and how the meaning of that identity varied according to context. In spaces of daily sociability, many Jews and Muslims formed harmonious, even close relationships with one another. But by the late 1930s, the political discussion around Muslim-Jewish relations in the French Mediterranean became increasingly, if not entirely, tense and even hostile. And these competing factors are illuminated particularly vividly through the itinerary of the Algerian Muslim musician and playwright Mahiaden Bachetaouzi and his acting and musical troupe El Moutribia. This group of performers, predominantly Jewish for many years, performed in Arabic before largely Muslim audiences and came to France annually beginning in the mid-1920s. El Moutribia helped to forge spaces where the culture of the southern Mediterranean became more immediately present in the metropole. The group both exemplified the period's frequently fluid and porous cultural boundaries between Jews and Muslims and the way that political events in the wider Mediterranean could harden divisions between the two groups. El Moutribia spent much of its time in mainland France in Paris, a city that was undergoing rapid change demographically, culturally, and at the level of daily experience. If the 19th century saw the emergence of what Julia Clancy Smith has dubbed a, quote, central Mediterranean corridor that crossed through France via Marseille, by the 1920s, the empire's increasingly cosmopolitan capital could be said to anchor a new extension, an elongated embayment, if you will, via which mainland France opened onto the Mediterranean and vice versa. Various Mediterranean subcultures were creating pockets of vital community politics and culture in countless Parisian spaces. Suddenly, Parisians out walking in certain quarters might regularly pass by a restaurant with North African or Balkan cuisine and smell the wafting scent of couscous, merguez, baklava, or other traditional, quote, Oriental or Arabic foods. They might see Jews or Muslims dressed in, quote, North African attire going about their daily lives in the city, or hear previously unfamiliar Arabic musical modes and instruments emanating from cafes, restaurants, and concert halls. While Jews and Muslims tended to live in distinct parts of Paris, certain regions of contact developed. The case of Paris's traditional Jewish neighborhood of the Marais is a striking example. Scholars have long documented, of course, how much of the quarter became, during this time, the heart of Parisian Yiddish culture. But what is less well known is that its lower portion, the Saint-Gervais, housed a small group of Jews from Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia and their cultural spaces. And a few Muslims also settled in the area, and larger numbers of them came to partake of what became a kind of shared Maghrebian ambiance in this quarter. And cafes in particular were key social gathering points. The central hub of activity, which was located sort of a stone's throw from the fashionable Parisian neighborhood of the Île Saint-Louis in the city's heart, ran along the Rue François Miron and the intersecting Rue de Joilly. And beginning in 1937, René-Mosé Garbi, a recent Jewish immigrant from Algeria, opened the Petite Marseillaise, which was a cafe-restaurant on the Rue François Miron that became one of the hot spots of the neighborhood. This cafe had about four family-sized tables just inside the entrance, four more in the back, a large bar. It also had the Garbi's apartment adjacent to it, and so it could hold a fairly sizable crowd. It specialized in couscous. On Saturday nights, the Petite Marseillaise regularly hosted musical soirees with Judeo-Arabic music. And a typical performance consisted of three North African Jewish musicians playing some combination of the tambourine, the darbuka, or the Arabic drum, the oud, the Arabic lute, and the violin to melodies from the ma'alouf, the traditional Arabo-Andalusian song. Two Muslim dancers would stand on a makeshift stage, and a crowd of as many as 100 Jews, Muslims, and Catholics came and sang and danced, usually starting around 8:30 at night, could go as late as 5 in the morning. These musical performances were part of a larger burgeoning Judeo-Arabic music revival crisscrossing the French Mediterranean in the years between the wars. Among the musicians who participated in these musical soirees at the Marais were occasionally three notable Algerian Jewish performers, Salim Halali, his mother Shelbia, and Lili Labassi. The younger Halali and Labassi were both part of Mahiaden Bachatalzi's musical and theater group El Mutribia. Now, Bachatalzi was a noted Algerian Muslim musician. He was one of the fathers, really, of modern popular theater in Algeria, and he was also politically active. I'll say a bit more about that in a few minutes. He supported Muslim integration into the Republic and Algerian cultural revival. In 1934, the 14-year-old Halali, who was a singer of Berber origin, who had this incredible soaring singing voice, he came, snuck his way, really, to the metropole on a boat from Annaba, Algeria, and he soon became a sensation in a lot of Spanish nightclubs in Paris, and he was really discovered in May of 1937 at the International Exposition in Paris by Bachatalzi at the Algerian booth. Now, Bachatalzi had actually long been involved in Jewish-Muslim musical interchanges. He had received his first training as a Quran reader in a mosque in Constantine. He had been discovered there by the Algerian Jewish musician Edmond Yafil, who was a key figure in the Andalusian musical revival in Algeria in the early 20th century. Yafil would sneak into mosques, actually, to hear Muslim liturgical melodies, and he first approached Bachatalzi after one of these times in a mosque and took him under his wing when Bachatalzi was still a teenager. Within a few years, Bachatalzi became the leading musician and then the day-to-day manager for Yafil's orchestra, El Mutribia. At the time, the orchestra had mostly Jewish musicians as well as a few Muslims, and it performed before largely Muslim audiences, which also always included some Jews. In the early 1920s, the orchestra started to focus attention not only on music but also on theater. Bachatalzi's career soon took off, and he brought his troupe to the metropole for tours on a regular basis. To promote his tours, Bachatalzi would write to a few Muslim friends from Algeria who were living in Paris and asked them to basically spread the news via word of mouth. After coming to the Metropole, musicians from the troupe would distribute posters in Arabic and Kabyle cafes, and he would invariably draw large crowds at his performances. During the mid to late 1930s, as he wrote and put on plays in Algeria and France, the plots and characters of many performances, like the makeup of his orchestra and theater troupe, defied the conventional hierarchies of colonialism or the binary oppositions of contemporary politics. So frequently his plays would deliberately blur or invert the positions of, quote, Europeans and indigènes, of Muslims and Jews, men and women, rich and poor, city and country folk, even though he would never fully eliminate these distinctions. He implied, therefore, his own vision of a Mediterranean France where differences, while recognized, needed to be negotiated within a more equitable and tolerant coexistence. The troupe's leader saw his endeavor to establish an Algerian theater canon, with plays set mostly in Arabic, as part of an effort to cultivate the emergence of an Algerian Muslim public. But as we've just seen, for years he relied upon a group of largely Jewish performers who periodically came to the Metropole, where they advertised in Muslim-owned cafes and performed in meeting halls before mostly Algerian Muslim workers. So altogether, this implied that within certain shared spaces of neighborhoods like the Lower Marais, in artistic settings like Bachatelzi's group, religious distinctions could give way to something akin to a common North African ethnicity. And yet, even here, we can't lose sight of another key factor, the French state. Sharp differences in Jewish and Muslim legal status were ever present, and they were often a divisive factor. Bachatelzi would recall, for instance, how in 1931, following a law limiting the movement of Algerian Muslims within the Metropole, administrative measures created fissures in the experiences of fellow musicians. Quote, "See here the consequences in an association like El Moutribia, made up of a very amicable mix of Muslims and Jews. Joseph, or Solomon, or Samuel, being a French citizen, was traveling as he wished, from Perpignan to Dunkirk, and from Biarritz to Strasbourg, while his buddy near whom he was seated like a brother every night in the orchestra, calling himself Khador or Ahmed, was benefiting from a special authorization of the prefecture limiting his visit to the time necessary to our concerts and obligating him to return home immediately." Nonetheless, relative amity prevailed. Bachatelzi describes the Jewish members of the group as, quote, "equally distressed as the Muslims by these measures." It's in this context that Salim Halali performed with Bachatelzi's company in cities across France and began a close collaboration with a comic singer and songwriter named Mohamed El Kamal. And together, Halali and El Kamal really created a new musical genre which had Andalusian roots. It was known as the flamenco in Arabic. By the late 1930s, they were performing along with a number of other Muslims and Jews in a growing scene of so-called Oriental cabarets that had opened in Paris far beyond the Lower Marais. And so at this moment, Jews and Muslims really are constantly imagining themselves and being imagined in a range of terms beyond Jewish, Muslim, and French: colonial, immigrant, Algerian, Oriental, Arab, and more. Meanwhile, however, the politics of the 1930s were increasingly driven by sharp boundaries that often relegated Jews and Muslims to the edges of French nationhood. As France faced economic depression, political crises, both domestic and foreign, a sense of cultural malaise, and increasing xenophobia and anti-Semitism, Jews and Muslims repeatedly sought to renegotiate their political relationship to France and to each other. In particular, they often found themselves in the crosshairs of the exclusionary visions of the far right groups like the Croix de Feu and the Parti Populaire Française that increasingly came to the fore in the mid to late 1930s. Few events illustrated better or did more to shape the impact from North Africa on Jewish and Muslim life in interwar France than the Constantine riots of August 3rd to 6th, 1934, an event that many claimed was provoked by the widely popular racist and anti-Semitic far right of Algeria. And I don't have time to detail these tragic events here, but suffice it to say that rioting that began on a Friday night with a dispute about a Jew showing disrespect for Muslims going to pray in a mosque culminated on Sunday with an intense burst of violence by a number of Muslims against a handful of Jewish-owned businesses and Jewish families. And in the end, 24 Jews and 4 Muslims lay dead and scores had been injured. Now, the strongest Muslim reaction to the riots in mainland France appeared among the followers of the Étoile Nord-Africaine, or ENA, the nascent Algerian Nationalist and Workers' Party. The ENA, which was led by the charismatic young activist Messali Hadj, consisted mostly of Algerian Muslim workers in urban areas of the Metropole, and it was particularly sizable in Paris. And Paris, broadly speaking, at this time, part of its Mediterranean character was that it was really becoming the northernmost hub for a whole series of often trans-Mediterranean, often radical political movements. Following the violence in Constantine, for more than 2 months, thousands of Muslims in Paris and its environs attended meetings, distributed pamphlets, and discussed the riots regularly in cafes. And this was after a period where the ENA's membership had really slumped, its finances had ebbed, and the riots essentially re-energized the party. And the often raucous crowds at these ENA meetings were drawn from the same ranks as the Kabyle manual laborers who had cheered many times for the Jewish musicians of Mahieddin Bachatouzi's orchestra. This should not surprise us. Both Jews and Muslims occupied multiple spheres. Their identities were formed through practices of common sociability, but they were also becoming increasingly politicized. At one of these ENA meetings with more than 500 spectators, it started with chants of "Down with the Jews, down with France." In these meetings, in its press and pamphlets, the ENA crafted a distinct narrative of the Constantine riots. The French imperialists and their Jewish collaborators had provoked the violence. The Muslims had justly defended themselves. ENA voices repeatedly extolled the Muslims as victims, martyrs, or nationalist heroes who received unfair treatment at the hands of the French. And the riot's impact was significant enough that it really marred the reception of Bachatouzi's troop when they arrived in France in August for their annual tour. Bachatouzi's sponsors told him that under the circumstances, quote, it would be impossible for them to come to applaud the Jewish musicians. Ultimately, in a compromise, the organizers attended the first of three performances. On the other two nights, sparse crowds booed Jews Lili Labassi and Alfred Sassi. Subsequently, Bachatouzi actually agreed to do a series of concerts only including his Muslim musicians for ENA crowds. There were also disputes between individual Jewish and Muslim musicians that broke out right at this time within El Moutribia in a way that was uncharacteristic. And so the riots really illustrated the situational nature of Jewish and Muslim ethnicity in the interwar French Mediterranean. It appeared that at least for the moment, these Jewish performers had ceased to be North African fellow musicians of the Jewish faith and become Jews exclusively, at odds with Muslims and absent from the nascent perception of an Algerian nation. 2 years later, very different trans-Mediterranean political circumstances reshaped once more the tenor and significance of Muslim-Jewish relations within El Moutribia. The anti-fascist Popular Front coalition, headed by Leon Blum, a proud Jew and the head of the Socialist Party, came to power in May of 1936. And in the face of the rise of fascism and xenophobia and colonial racism, as well as deepening economic and political crisis, the group had elicited substantial support from many Jews and Muslims. Soon, the so-called Blum-Violette Reform Bill would be announced, which proposed citizenship for 25,000 Algerian Muslims based on the attainment of a certain degree of military rank or higher education without their having to surrender their so-called personal status as Muslims. And after the PAF's election, Bachatouzi dedicated a song to Leon Blum, whom he later described as, for Muslims at this time, our great man. He concluded the work entitled The Voice of Algeria and written otherwise entirely in Arabic with a French phrase that exclaimed, quote, it is really thanks to Leon Blum that I have been able to speak. This combination of linguistic, cultural, and political references was typical of Bachatouzi and emblematic of a moment where particularism and universalism coexisted uneasily in liberal visions of the imperial nation state. When performed in France in autumn 1936, the song drew huge, enthusiastic crowds of Muslims. Bachatouzi recalled, quote, it was not without pleasure that our Israeli comrades of El Moutribia heard the ecstatic roar that greeted the name of Leon Blum. They found here a revenge for the unfortunate incidents following the riots of Constantine 2 years earlier. So by focusing briefly on the case of El Moutribia, what I've tried to show here is how from neighborhoods to national debates, Jews and Muslims helped to render the Mediterranean socially, culturally, and politically increasingly important in interwar metropolitan life. In select neighborhoods of Paris and other cities, France's first generation of Jewish and Muslim immigrants from Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia forged what would come to be seen as, quote, North African spaces. And these settings were characterized by a range of everyday encounters in which the meanings of culture and ethnicity remained fluid and contingent. At the same time, however, the status of the same Jews and Muslims and the two groups' mutual perceptions continued to be shaped profoundly by their relationship to the state and to competing political currents. Jews remained far more integrated into the French polity than Muslims, and individual Jews came to hold significant power in policymaking that affected millions of Muslims. By the late 1930s, the solidarities expressed in everyday interaction became strained by the increasingly accepted ethno-religious terms of French politics that initially emanated from the far right. Soon these terms helped to set the stage for newly racial boundaries of French nationhood and of Jewish-Muslim interaction under Vichy and the German occupation. And as the French Mediterranean became subject to a contest between German fascism and French authoritarianism, the relationships of Algerian Muslim and Jewish performers like Mahiaden Bachatalzi, Salim Halali, and Mohamed El Kamal could hardly escape the period's powerful racial logic. But that is the subject for another paper. Thank you.